I was trying to pick up one paper. The
Can you keep your hands up?
Paper. It it elegantly surveys the perfectionist egalitarian terrain, showing that there are the many different choices, many different nodes where we have to make decisions. There are different ways you can go. So there are, there's a lot of variety of views. So to give the view a sensible run for its money, you have to make sensible choices. There are a lot of these decision nodes, and we make a lot of sensible choices, and also just illustrate the terrain very well. Just to pick up on a couple of points. One is capability versus functions, a big issue. I mean, I think to think about this, think about cases where the two views will really conflict and give you different implications. So think about one kind of case, would be cases where by restricting people's opportunities, that you get higher in functions, and then think about, are there cases where you go along? What is it that we really care about there? Another kind of case that's similar, I think, is just a case where if providing opportunities to people, capabilities, mattered per se, then it should matter even in a case where we know absolutely providing the capabilities will do no good for anybody. You know, we could give you resources which will unequivocally expand your capabilities, there'll be eggs on the shore, but you just know that Arneson is going to, carelessly crack the eggs, and it's going to do him no good. I just think any obligation to provide aid lapses in that case, and that's because that's indication that what we really care about is the achieved functions, not the capabilities. The capabilities matter partly because they're part of functioning, and partly because for instrumental reasons. But ultimately, we don't really want to take an ex post, not an ex ante perspective. It's not a question of risk. I mean, if it's more valuable to go up the mountain by a risky route where you might fail versus a slog up the side, that will show up in the functions, a fine-grained view of the functions, right? So that's not the issue at all. So opportunity versus function. And then responsibility. And it seems to me, I think that the egalitarian perfectionist should take on some view on responsibility as mattering, not just in instrumental, it obviously matters in instrumental terms in big, huge ways, but for its own sake, I think that it's a long story, but I think the best candidate is kind of desertitarian. So that if you think about it, the egalitarian perfectionist, other things being equal, should prefer the world in which the saints are flourishing, as it were, and the sinners are languishing, they're not doing quite as well, rather than the world that's reversed. And we care about that not just for instrumental reasons, but really for its own sake. And that's obviously judgment. That's a big issue. The third thing, just real quickly, is I used to trip on shameful revelation. I think there's a big important issue here, but you need to think about it. So the question is, should the state not investigate people? We're wondering whether the rich, in some sense, they've acquired their wealth in some way that we shouldn't touch it. We have some inhibition against taking from it, or for the people who are badly off. Have they got to that predicament in some way that somehow dampens their claim to aid? So the worry is, Joe Wolf suggests it's a kind of absolute thing, no shameful revelation in these guys. But look, think of a soup kitchen in Los Angeles. The soup kitchen is stigmatizing. It's a visible mark of low status to show up in a soup kitchen and get soup, St. Francis, the Paul Society. But that's inherently connected with the fact that the soup kitchen does an extremely good job of targeting the truly needy, the people who are really down and out. If that wasn't true, if somehow, trendy Hollywood actresses, Nicole Kidman and their friends started showing up at the soup kitchen, would no longer be stigmatizing. But it would also be no longer targeted. People would say, why should I give to the soup kitchen and feed all those Nicole Kidman? She's not one of the truly needy. So there's a trade-off here. Sometimes you want to have separating policies that separate people off, but then often that the targeting will in itself involve stigma. Sometimes you don't want to separate, you want to treat everybody the same to avoid cost of stigma. This issue, I think, crops up all over the place. It's big and tricky, but the one thing we don't want to do is say, no stigma, absolutely. No shame for it. That's just the wrong way to go.
Well, thanks. A lot of what you said was sympathetic, so that was nice to hear. But I'm not sure whether I agree with you about the soup kitchen analogy, because soup kitchens are so obviously the symptom of a highly defective means of redistributing wealth and looking after the disadvantaged. And the stigma is part of the problem with soup kitchens. So I would never...
Well, a better society, fancy lunch kitchens.
I think a better society would not have soup kitchens. I mean, the society, I mean, there's a very much a utopian cast to my paper, but I am aspiring to a society that has transcended the soup kitchen. Because in part of the stigma, and I think Scandinavian social democrats were often sneering at North Americans for not being more conscious of the actual effectiveness of universal programs. Not just that they don't have stigma, but they actually are more effective at making for a more equal society. Now, that's an empirical question. I don't know enough about it, but I would certainly, you're right, if it's shameful revelation and meeting needs versus no shameful revelation, no meeting needs, I'll go for the former, but I think that's a limited imagination on what equality could involve.
Okay, I'm just going to go through the list that I have in case I missed you somehow, so you know who's next. And some of you, I don't know your name, so I'll have an identifying feature. So I have Colin, the fellow in the striped shirt, Daniel behind him, Steve Macedo, Alan Patton, Genevieve, and the Blue Jays fan. Yes. All right, so Colin.
My question's for Stephen. It's about the status of the perfectionist policies and fair education. So, I mean, one worry about some perfectionist policies, the sort of worry that Dworkin has on some faces, is that it involves unfair subsidization of certain views, right? You know, if we give to the opera, baseball fans are subsidizing the opera fans, and that seems unfair. So you seem sensitive to this worry in a certain way, right? Because you don't want that to happen. But it seems to me your fair aggregation procedure has, in some context, has the perverse impact of denying the ability of the state to promote the worthy ends. Right? So consider a state which there are either baseball fans or opera fans. Right? So there's 10% are opera fans and 90% are baseball fans. Right? And the opera people want, they feel like they need state support for their activities. And so do the baseball folks, right? So, your proposal seems to be to fund them proportionally, which means not funding them at all, right? And so it looks like, in real terms, the perfectionists sometimes have to say, no, there's enough baseball, right? There's not enough opera. And we're gonna make the baseball people pay for some of the opera, right? And then you need to tell a story about why that's fair. But if you say, well, you know, we're just going to do it proportionally, then the background society may be such that there's no room for the state to do it and respect that proportional support.
That strikes me as correct. But I guess I just kind of was hand-waving toward an account of fair aggregation. Right? Seeing this as a way of blocking the idea that to avoid arbitrary discrimination, you need to accept restricted neutrality. So I was thinking, in some contexts, you can block that by appealing to fair aggregation. That requires a developed theory of fair aggregation. And as you see from my paper, there's not much of a theory. I mean, I mentioned the possibility of proportional support, but I think you're right that if you would want to look at the underlying, what's going on in society, and if there's more than enough baseball, then maybe there's not an important reason there to be funding baseball. So I guess I'm happy to think more about what fair aggregation requires. I mean, the only thing that I really said is in some vague way the numbers matter, but I don't have a worked out account of how the conflicting interests of people should be fairly aggregated. So, it's not really answering your question, but just acknowledging there's not really an account in the paper. There's just like gesturing toward.
Okay.
possibility of such an account. Thanks.
The stripes. Sorry, what's your name?
Ian Cowan. This is for Professor Wolf. Again, it's on verification. It's just a subtle paper, and I'm not sure I followed it entirely correctly. So this is very much in the way of a request for clarification rather than an objection.
So in introducing the paper, you say that you assume the truth of
body pluralism, which were to take to be roughly the thesis that there are a variety of incompatible but equally or incommensurable viable ideals of a good life. And then during the paper, the fair aggregation strategy emerges as an alternative to the restrictive principle of neutrality. And as far as I can see, the fair aggregation strategy is plausible if we take the goods in question to be equally valuable. It's less obvious to me that it's threatening, that it's a reasonable response to incommensurable goods. Because we don't have the same implicit assurance that overall good is higher if we follow the fair aggregation strategy in the case of incommensurable goods. If goods are truly incommensurable, then it just isn't the case that we can say that the greater good lies with the greater number, and so I just don't think we can say that numbers matter. And in the conclusion of the paper, you didn't get to say, but you write, if the restrictive principle of neutrality is construed to be a general principle that applies to all state action, then it's a plausible principle. There are contexts in which it's fitting and proper for the state to favor some ideals over other equally worthy ideals, provided that it does so in a way that does not arbitrarily discriminate between its members. So these are the contexts in which the non-neutral but fair aggregation of conflicting interests is appropriate. So I just thought that the restrictive principle of neutrality is threatened by fair aggregation if we take this to be equal, but not if we take them to be incommensurable. So I'm just not sure whether you can have an argument here in this one single paper that doesn't seem to distinguish between the two different responses that we'd have to give if goods were equally valuable or if goods were strictly incommensurable.
The idea behind fair aggregation wasn't to maximize the amount of good. It was motivated by the thought that you need to treat people who hold different ideals that are equally worthwhile, whether we cast out in terms of equality, value, or incrementability, or some other notion. So that was the thought, that it's treating these people fairly that leads to a concern about how you aggregate the interests. Now, if that's the focus, I don't see why it would matter, why we'd need a different story for equality of value and incommensurability of value. I mean, what these people can say is you're favoring an ideal, which, I mean, suppose everything's just transparent, this is all artificial, but the state says, yeah, we're favoring this, and it's no better than what you're pursuing. That person then can then say, well, this just looks like arbitrary favoritism, right? And then I'm thinking there are contexts where they can appeal to the numbers and things like that. They can give a fair aggregation answer, and that silences the complaint of unfairness. So that's how I was thinking about it. Does that help?
I'm not sure. If the goods are equally good, then it seems a sensible response to say that some kind of fair aggregation is a reasonable response to that, to the objection. If they're actually incommensurable, then why does it matter that there are more people on one side? The idea is to promote the good, right? The principle of the restrictive principle of neutrality seems to me to be a better response than fair aggregation in the case of incommensurable goods.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, I guess what I thought we were arguing was the welfare interests of people, right? So those could be comparable, even if goods that they're pursuing, that, you know, contribute to the goodness of their lives in certain situations aren't comparable. So I'm sure more needs to be said on that. Thanks.
Daniel?
So this question is sort of sparked by Christine's paper, but I have a feeling that there's issues in Stephen's paper that are also relevant to it. So actually, anybody who wanted to say say something to it, I'd be happy to hear from you. So, Christine, you cited, I found myself sort of very stimulated by your paper, but disagreeing with it quite a lot. And when you sort of invoked my sort of off-the-cuff Benji Britney thing from yesterday, I thought that, first of all, I should clarify what I meant. For me, the reason why there's a mild perfectionist case for the state funding classical radio stations has everything to do with giving people the ability to choose in an informed manner. So, you know, the market deluges them with Britney, but not so much with Britain, you know. And so we need a little bit of propping up of Britain in order for them to be able to choose between Benji and Britney. Now, as far as I'm concerned, if it turns out that having listened to some Britain and having had, you know, the classical music radio guy telling them about all of the subtle atonal things they should be trying to appreciate, they end up saying, thank you very much, give me my Britney, that's fine with me, right? What my concern was all about not the quality of, not the content of the choice, but the circumstances in which the choice is made. It seems that a lot of the time we talk about people making informed choices amongst a lot of different things, and actually they're not in a context where they can actually make those choices in an informed manner. So that's what I was on about. So that's just by way of clarification, sort of to create a little bit of distance between us where I think you were sensing more commonality. Now, here's my substantive question. I get very, very nervous when people start using the context of the concept of flourishing outside of kind of an Aristotelian context, right? So in Aristotle, you know, the notion of flourishing, whatever the Greek term was, makes sense in the context of an empirical account of human biology, a teleological account of human biology, which says that, you know, there are ends that in a way our nature is naturally driven towards, and, you know, it's good for us that we be able to, I mean, this is simplifying wildly. Now, it turns out that account is completely false, right? It's of historical interest, but it's false. So flourishing turns out, is an irreducibly normative concept, right? But it sounded to me like you were still trying to make it sound like it had some kind of empirical basis. In other words, there are facts of the matter about what human flourishing consists in. And now, there could be the facts of the matter about what happiness consists in. You know, we may be able to determine greater or lesser degrees of human happiness in various sort of quantitative ways. But it seems to me that happiness and flourishing are two different things. We may want it to be the case that which we sort of intellectuals think make people flourish is also what's going to make them happy. But it could turn out that that's just wrong, right? It could turn out that not all good things go together. It could turn out, again, that people will, given the choice, prefer Britney to Britain, you know, or whatever. So I guess my question, this is sort of rambly, so I'll finish it off with a question. I wasn't sure exactly that the concept of flourishing, in a way, allows you to sit on a fence, which I don't think you're entitled to sit in. It sounds kind of empirical, because flourishing is like, you know, we know what it means for a tree to flourish, you know. But in fact, the context which would allow you to have an empirical concept of flourishing seems to me to be one that we really have to run 100 miles away from. And so then your concept of flourishing becomes irreducibly normative and therefore contestable, which is fine, right? We can debate about what it is that makes people flourish. But it sounded to me like you wanted a concept of flourishing that wasn't going to be controversial in that way, that could be kind of consensual. Do you see where I'm not satisfied with how that came out, but there's at least a set of concerns.
Let me put you out of your misery.
Sorry.
I think flourishing is a factual matter.
Yeah.
And I think we actually, in fact, have that intuitively sense that in a lot of our practices. Flourishing includes happiness, but it's not just happiness, it's actually doing things that are worthwhile. Now, to try and promote flourishing is not a matter of banning Britney Spears, forcing people to listen to Benjamin Britten, but it's a matter of doing the kinds of things that you were suggesting, making it available. But I think it's disingenuous when liberals like yourself say that, oh, well, all I really want is that to be there as a choice for people to avail themselves of, because we don't think we should have polka on the radio so people can avail themselves of that, because we think it's crap. right? So we want available the choices that are, well, sorry, poker fans out there. But we want available the, valuable options. And that's why Benjamin Britten is something we want available. And we don't think there has to be just a plethora of choices, as many as possible. We actually look for the good ones. And so all the tying themselves in knots over arts funding that liberals do, I think, is just an indication that they can't fess up to the fact that we really actually have perfectionist intuitions on this. We do know, within a very wide range, what is a likely candidate for flourishing and what is not. And we actually have in place policies that do it. We have policies that support classical music over polka in our liberal societies.
Steve, and I'm going to have to start asking people to be quicker, because should we end at 12:30? Is that? Okay,
yeah,
so
it's
12:20. It's up to the organizers. Sure.
It's 30? Yeah, I guess for 15 minutes.
Maybe. Another 15 minutes?
And then start 15 minutes?
Yes.
Okay, so Steve.
So I just very much agree with Christine just said, because obviously when you pick out classical music as the market failure, you're picking something out not at random. We don't have much midget mud wrestling either, but you picked out Benjamin Britten, not that. So I completely agree with you, and I'm just going to make the suggestion that, Rawls says, there's been sort of talk about no reasonable rejectability, all reasonable people can accept, and so on. I mean, he says that, look, I think people may be trying to get too much out of very abstract principles and kind of legislating too much from on high with respect to what become very difficult matters of justification in the legislative arena. So, he tended to confine these judgments to the constitutional essentials and the basic structure and so on. I think with the thought that if we secure people's fundamental liberties at that level, if we guarantee people some basic forms of equality at that level, where we provided them with social bases of self-respect and so on, then the rough and tumble of deliberation that involves more controversial conceptions of the good, and I think I'm agreeing with Steve, could be, as long as we're fair-minded about it, as long as we're reasonably encompassing about it, I think I'm agreeing with both Steve and Christine, as long as we're fair across citizens who have different conceptions of what's good, well, we can admit more controversial notions at the legislative discretion stage, and in a way it would be, as we do, and in a way it would be crazy not to, given that politics is useful for solving lots of collective action problems and for coordinating our conduct and all sorts of things that are valuable, and we've sort of done at the constitutional stage a lot of the work of securing people's fundamental liberties, fundamental guarantees, and so on, and there's less at stake in normal politics and so on, so we can admit more controversial notions. So I just make the suggestion that I don't have a specific account of exactly what to admit and what not. We need a further account of that. Theories of deliberative democracy would so to speak, to that. But that we distinguish between the constitutional level and the sort of ordinary politics level when thinking of, when applying these ideas that are in search of some sort of very wide consensus of principles.
It seemed like a lot of the early formulations of state neutrality took the problem to be the coercive power of the state, which is there both at the level of constitutional essentials and at the legislative stage. I think the Rawls move to restrict it to constitutional essentials is a retreat. And I also think that it's never really clear in Rawls like how you draw the line between what falls on one side or the other. Which means there's wiggle room.
Yeah.
So when a good counterexample is presented to the Rawlsian liberal, if he's really troubled by the counterexample, he can put it on.
Yeah.
Besides, and then one last thing, when Rawls in political liberalism, he expresses different attitudes about perfectionism at the legislative stage. Like sometimes he seems to be saying, that's just not something I'm talking about. What I really care about is what's happening in the constitutional essentials. Other times he seems to suggest it's almost healthy to have controversial ideas discussed there. And other times he suggests kind of some worries about it. So I'm I'm just puzzled by.
I think I just say he's generally very good at recognizing that sort of theorizing needs to go on in a way that's specific to the question at hand. And I think the question at hand, when you're talking about constitutional essentials and matters of basic justice, is one question, and then at the legislative, it'll be limited by that, obviously. But separate questions will have to be addressed. But I agree with you; it's kind of open ended as to how.
Andrew, one.
The other thing to say here is that if for Rawls, the basic question was, how do we design our whole social structure? So a starting point isn't, you know, how do we justify state action, focusing on state and all state action being coercive, but what's our choice of the ground rules of a social system? And so I think when you frame it that way, it is a much less libertarian cast than when you say, you know, we assume all state action is coercive, how can it be justified?
Alan?
Question for Steve. I think wanted to ask you the question that you said you were kind of worried about a couple times in the paper in your response to Arash, and that's whether or not the argument about expressive recognition actually pushes you much closer to the liberal principle, and you can't just stop at the restrictive principle. So when I compare the restrictive principle and the liberal principle, as you initially formulated them on pages 5 and 6, one thing that strikes me is that the restricted principle has a kind of comparative aspect to it, or incomparative aspect. So it applies to ideals that cannot be ranked by reason as better or worse than each other, or I think ideals that are equally worthwhile, you say at another point. Whereas if you look at the liberal principle, it has more of a threshold condition, which is the permissibility condition, right? So one thought, first of all, is that you could imagine lots of other principles, right, which either had which had different threshold, like somewhat higher threshold conditions, but not, but that were still distinct from the comparative principle. And I think that something like that is actually what the expressive argument gets you. So when you respond to the expressive to the worry that you imagine, you give the example of someone with a racist conception of the good and say, well, there's nothing wrong with expressing society's disapproval of such a conception because it really seems awful for people to have those, and it's not in their interest to have society's approval. Well, that would already be covered by the liberal principle, since that seems like it's an impermissible impermissible conception. You can imagine a different version of that response, which is the grass cutters one, but I think you could handle that by having a slightly higher threshold condition, but still a threshold condition rather than the comparative condition that's built into the restricted principle. So in other words, the higher threshold would exclude A, impermissible conceptions of the good, and B, worthless conceptions of the good. But anything that's above that threshold would seem to be fair game as far as the expressive argument's concerned.
Great, thanks, that's helpful. So what we're imagining here is some good ideals that are not as good, not of equal value to other ideals, right, but still good. So they're not pointless, and they're not wicked,
right,
but they're inferior. But they still, right, would allow someone to have a decent life, if not the best life. And so with respect to those, maybe I should be more sympathetic about self-respect of those persons. Thanks, I'll think about that.
Cynthia?
How many people are there?
There's two after you. You pass? Yes. I don't know your name.
So. I'm Chad Warren from Toronto. My question is for Christine, and it concerns, I was just a little bit confused about how some conception of responsibility is supposed to be consistent with your account. And this might just be a clarificatory question. But I mean, one of the things that you say under responsibility and well-being is that the flourishing approach sees failure to contribute as a lack of flourishing and a kind of inequality. And so it seemed to follow from that it's also a matter for the state to be concerned with correcting, right? And so it seems like on your view, there's no point at which I can say that my lack of flourishing is my problem, right? And So, and I take it that that's not because you think flourishing is what is to be equalized. It's because you take an impact view, right? And so, I mean, one of the things that motivates people to be resourcists is that it makes it very intuitive to draw this line that there's sort of what Rawls calls the social division of responsibility, that the society is responsible for providing you with the means to live a good life, and you're responsible for what you do with it. And so on that view, you know, instead of being concerned with sort of what goods do for people, we're concerned with what people do with goods. And I wonder, I have two questions. One is on your view, is responsibility to be understood in terms of a sort of stopping point beyond which we've done as much as we need to do for someone and the rest is up to them? Or do you have some other conception? And if it's the former, then how do you draw that line sort of consistent with the impact view of what's to be equalized?
Well, that's a good question. Obviously, it would be a very implausible view if we just sort of constantly devoted our energies on the unproductive and tried to keep sort of G-ing them up or trying to cajole them into being contributors. So I guess I'm thinking much more in a general, with a more general perspective, that we look across society and see what are the rates of contribution more generally, and see what kinds of social policies we can devise to raise that level, to encourage people to be more, to contribute more, and rather than to have, say, a social worker constantly arriving at your doorstep, getting you to be productive and contributing. And then I think if we take that more general abstract approach, we evade the obvious issue of paternalistic meddlesome, really, intervention on the part of the state. It is also rather costly, possibly counterproductive.
George Craig?
Just enough time. I've got a question for Steve. Your restricted neutrality principle. Now, I take it that you're saying that the state should be neutral among conceptions of the good that equally or incommensurably worthwhile, but it needn't be or it shouldn't be neutral on conceptions of the good that are not worthwhile. I just wondered that, especially in view of your value pluralist starting point, what separates the worthwhile from the not worthwhile, especially since you've defined pluralism as involving the incommensurability of practices or whole conceptions of the good.
That's a huge question. But
should have saved it for lunch.
But pluralists, as you know, right, do not want to just slip into some type of nihilism in which there can be no judgments between better and worse. So the pluralist is committed to allowing for the possibility. It has to allow the possibility for the distinction between worthwhile and worthless. So that's up for negotiation. You don't get anything in my paper that tells us how to do that. But if I tried to do that, then I wouldn't be talking about restricted neutrality. I'd be talking about objective lists and the problems with subjectivism about the good and all that kind of interesting stuff.
Okay, thanks. Okay, thank you very much. So I guess we'll restart at 1:45.